The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and in today's broadcast, I'm going to focus on the Nobel Prize-winning philosopher, author, Albert Camus, to mark the discovery this year in the archives of Charles de Gaulle of a previously unpublished letter from Albert Camus to Charles de Gaulle, written during the Nazi occupation of France. I'll read several New Yorker articles about Camus, as well as excerpts from his writings. Well, let's get started. I'll start with an article written by Adam Gopnik in the February 21st, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine. It's called Reading a Lost Wartime Letter from Albert Camus in 2020. Some writers speak to us through the window of their time. We need to get back to where they once belonged to truly focus on the shape of their ideas. And a few speak to us permanently, jumping with wormhole-like fluidity from their time into ours. The latter are an unpredictable bunch. And their presence doesn't seem to depend on a certain quality of thought as much as on a kind of lucidity of spirit. We have to work hard, for instance, to make sense of Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophical writings with their odd brew of German theory and contemporary French politics. Reading them is rewarding work. But Albert Camus, Sartre's great colleague and rival, still speaks to us directly, even though his time is as remote from ours as Sartre's. Camus was not a broad thinker, or even, in a sense, an original one. But he earned the quality that kids used to describe admiringly as deep, as in Leonard Cohen is deep. What he said on every subject was always simple and profound, and usually right. We read him as our contemporary, and he rarely lets us down. He is still hugely popular, as is his daughter, Catherine, said not long ago, because he writes not in an attempt to find the plot in history and get in on the right side of it, but in the name of history's victims. This thought is set in motion by the discovery last year in France of a previously unknown letter by Camus, found in the archives of Charles de Gaulle by the biographer and scholar Vincent Duclair, which Camus had sent him from Paris to London sometime in 1943. Unsigned, but instantly identifiable by tone and context, it is headed "From a Resisting Intellectual," and was excerpted by the newspaper Le Figaro last month with the agreement of Catherine Camus. It also appears in a new book by Duclair about her father. It's an odd letter and very French, a sonorous philosophical account of the crisis of the French resistance and its future, stepping delicately through various minefields of inter-resistance solidarity, and yet a letter that, though intently rooted in its own time, nonetheless manages with eerie prescience to speak to some of the quarrels of our own. Camus, a French Algerian by birth, spent the war first in Lyon, where he wrote drafts of his novel The Stranger, and then in Paris, where he wrote editorials for the underground resistance journal Combat. Indeed, the tone and style of the letter is so close to that of the editorials that it instantly jumps out as his. The shape of the circumstance is well known. The resistance, in a complicated pattern, was ostensibly led from London by a right-wing military leader, de Gaulle, but fought in France by a coalition of conservative, Catholic, patriotic, and fiercely anti-Nazi forces, along with a restless and suspicious assembly of Republican liberal forces, including old-time socialists, supported by a strong component of communists, who, having sat out the beginning of the war at the time of the Stalin-Hitler Pact, came fiercely and bravely into armed resistance once the Soviet Union was invaded. In the letter, Camus writes first of the foundering of the elite, the intellectual and administrative and even military class who were the pride of French meritocracy. He begins on a note of balanced, even-eyed vision that, difficult to maintain at the best of times, was heroically hard to keep at a moment of such, well, existential stress. Here, I very briefly summarize the feelings of a French intellectual, he writes, in the face of the current situation as it can be observed from within the interior. To put it plainly, one's first feelings would be those of anguish. My deep conviction is that the form of war that metropolitan France has adopted, and in which we are all engaged, can lead either to the rebirth of this people or to its definitive fall. The failings of that elite were, it seemed, responsible for the strange defeat of France, as the historian Marc Bloch put it. As Picasso remarked to Matisse, the French generals were the professors of beaux arts, that is, part of the same blind administrative cadre. How could one think of this elite now, the letter asks, and how ought it to reconstitute itself after the war was won? If it was won. A nation dies, Camus writes, because its elite melts, literally. But that elite can be remade not from the traditional class of administrative exam passers, but from a new elite of the resistors, whose expertise is rooted in real experience, and who keep their reality about them. He complains that direct and armed resistance within France has not as yet been met with military action from outside, overestimating, perhaps, the resources of the French army in exile, but impatient for the second front that had long been promised, but was delivered only in June of 1944. On what foundation can the future of France be built? Torn between the American and Soviet models, at a moment when the prestige of the Soviet Union, due to the success of its army against the Nazis, was at an all-time high, Camus speaks up for Russia and its social experiment, but says delicately that France can only, quote, admit with difficulty the idea of a preponderant state where all liberty would disappear, end quote. He writes that while we have to seek social justice of the kind that the Soviets at least pretended to pursue, claims of personal liberty cannot be scanted or treated as secondary. Critical of an ascendant American power that he identifies as, quote, a future that far too much resembles the past, end quote, and in which, quote, under the pretext of liberty, justice is put deliberately to one side, end quote. Camus goes on to insist, nonetheless, on the centrality of liberty as the essential protector of history's victims. What, then, is the ideology of the French Resistance? If we have a doctrine to formulate, he writes, it would be one of a balance of justice and of liberty. Certainly difficult to realize, but outside of which nothing can be done. Justice and liberty. What demands could be more basic, even more fatuous? But with Camus, a simplicity of speech can never conceal the significance, the high stakes of his articulation. Tempted by the Soviet model, he nonetheless refuses it, recognizing it as too brutal and monolithic. Presented with what was perceived as Western in as a Western imperialist model that seemed to offer more of the same path that had led France to its downfall, he calls for a revolution in justice, along with a perpetual renewal of freedom. In Camus' vision, which he no doubt shared fruitlessly with de Gaulle, who had other, less philosophical things to worry about, justice, including economic justice, is meaningless without an equally passionate commitment to liberty. These truths are, or ought to be, easy enough for us to affirm today. To do so at the height of the war, when rhetoric and political exigencies could and did lead many otherwise intelligent people to either slavish allegiance to Stalin or, still worse, collaboration with the Nazis. Took Camusian clarity. It wasn't easy to say all this at a moment of crisis. Yet, these are Camus' perpetual themes. The need for liberty, not as a commonplace cliché, but as a condition that fills our lives. The freedom to think for ourselves and not be stampeded by mass approval. The dangerous grip that the abstractions of ideology can have on us. The responsibility to see injustice clearly and to have the courage to fight it. The readiness to conclude, as Camus' character Jean Tourou from his novel The Plague does, that there are pestilences and there are victims, and it's up to us, as far as possible, not to join the forces with the pestilences. And all of them still need to be heard again and again. The leading Camus scholar Robert Zaretsky wrote not long ago about how newly relevant Camus' existentialism, once safely part of the past, can seem in our current crisis. The existentialist, Zaretsky points out, attach a crucial rider to the usual claims we make for moral universality. Quote, we must also accept that other choices by other people in the same situation can be equally good and equally defensible, end quote. Humanity itself is what we have to fight for, accepting all the compromises and half-measures that are essential to human existence, and neither condemning them too readily nor forgiving them too easily. Camus reveals himself in his way as that most horrible of things, a centrist. But centrism is a necessary condition, if a very bad name, for the simple effort of turning one's head around to see the whole horizon. Seeking the middle on every question is foolish. Being centered to see the world as it is, just essential sense. At the time Camus wrote his letter, resistance was not a self-congratulatory rhetorical position, but a life or death risk that taken every day. And yet he was still prepared to put his life on the line for the view that there is no one line to follow in life. Camus believed, even in extremists, that an educated elite, meaning merely a concert of committed minds renewed by lived experience, was essential to a sane society. Reading him now, at a time when we need to be reminded again that every attempted depreciation of civil liberty as secondary or inessential to our progress is obscene. When every attempt to seal off our idea of liberation from an ideal of social justice is doomed. Camus, the resisting intellectual, demonstrates that the modesty of a political program need not be a barrier to the heroism of the deeds it inspires. And now, from the April 20th, 1946 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Talk of the Town section, Aberdeist by Lewis Thompson and A.J. Liebling. Albert Camus, the young French author, is over here for a few lectures and the appearance of his novel, The Stranger. He has an idea for a daily newspaper that would take a lot of the fun out of newspapering. It would be a critical newspaper to be published 1 hour after the first editions of the other papers, twice a day, morning and evening, he told us when we called on him in a hotel on West 70th Street, where he had spent his first 5 days in America. It would evaluate the probable element of truth in the other papers' main stories with due regard to editorial policies and the past performances of the correspondents. Once equipped with a card indexed dossiers on the correspondents, a critical newspaper could work very fast. After a few weeks, the whole tone of the press would conform more closely to reality, an international service. Monsieur Camus, who is 32 and dresses like a character in Harold T. 2018, retired 6 months ago as editor-in-chief of Combat, a Paris daily he directed during the German occupation when it was extra-legal. In the first year following the liberation, he made Combat the most interesting independent journal in France. Combat now, he thinks, has passed from independence to a simple habit of negation, which isn't the same thing. For the time being, Camus is more interested in further novels. His play Caligula, which has been bought for New York production, and his philosophy of the absurd than he is in journalism. He is often cited as an existentialist, like his friend Jean-Paul Sartre, but he says he is not. His philosophy is not the same thing at all as Sartre's, whose disciples, he says, are impressed with the consciousness of existence, which is, to them, at times, a mystic pleasure, and rather more often a pain in the neck. What burns Camus is the necessity to stop existing. He believes man's relation to the universe is absurd because man must die. But he also believes that acceptance of this relation is the mark of maturity. Sisyphus, who was condemned to push a rock up a hill in Hades and then see it roll down again, is Camus' symbol. He knew what he was up against, but he kept on pushing. For a man arrived at such a grim conclusion, Monsieur Camus seemed unduly cheerful, as did, in fact, Monsieur Sartre, when he was here some weeks ago. Just because you have pessimistic thoughts, you don't have to act pessimistic, Camus said. One has to pass the time somehow. Look at Don Juan. He detests the kind of realism that confounds greatness with strength and material success. The dangerous part he took in the resistance was an assertion of his disagreement with this concept. When we saw him, he was looking at the translation of The Stranger for the first time. There are too many quotation marks in it, he said. I am sure that there weren't that many quotation marks in the original. Camus has a snub-nosed face that looks more Spanish than French. His mother, who was born in Algeria, was of Spanish blood. His father, also born in Algeria, belonged to one of the Alsatian families that moved there after the war of 1870 to 71, rather than become German. Camus was born in Algiers himself and is, we got him to admit without too much trouble, the first top-notch French writer born in North Africa. His birth there gave him a distinctive chemistry because the European cities in French North Africa are as new and ruthlessly commercial as Birmingham or Detroit. They have their color problem, with accompanying overtones of guilt. They're competing immigrant strains. Camus' parentage combines two, and their savage and explicit anti-Semitism. The proportion of Jews to Christians is much higher than in continental France. They also have their crude and desperate first or second generation millionaires who have never learned that it sometimes pays to be reasonable. The summers are extreme, like New York's. Camus graduated from the University of Algiers and moved to France only in 1940. The thing that bothered him about France at first was the oversupply of historic and literary associations. What the heart craves at certain moments is places without poetry, he once wrote. West 70th Street ought to suit him just fine. And now, from the A Critic at Large section of the April 9, 2012 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Facing History, Why We Love Camus, by Adam Gopnik. Abjuring abstraction and extremism, Camus found a way to write about politics that was sober, lofty, and a little sad. The French novelist and philosopher Albert Camus was a terrifically good-looking guy with whom women fell for helplessly, the Don Draper of existentialism. This may seem a trivial thing to harp on, except that it almost always the first thing that comes up when people who knew Camus talk about what he was like. Elizabeth Hawes' lovely book, in 2009, Camus, A Romance, is essentially the rueful story of her own college girl crush on his image. Ms. Hawes asked survivors of the partisan review crowd who met Camus on his one trip to New York in 1946 what he was like, and they said that he reminded them of Bogart. "All I can tell you is that Camus was the most attractive man I have ever met," William Phillips, the journal's editor, said, while the thorny Lionel Abel not only compared him to Bogart, but kept telling Hawes that Camus' central trait was his elegance. It took the sharper and more Francophile eye of A.J. Liebling to note that the suit Camus wore in New York was at least 20 years out of Parisian style. Camus liked this reception enough to write home about it to his French publisher. "You know, I can get a film contract whenever I want," he wrote, joking a little, but only a little. Looking at the famous portrait of Camus by Cartier-Bresson from the 40s, trench coat collar up, hair swept back, and cigarette in mouth, long appealing lined face and active warm eyes, you see why people thought of him as a star and not just as a sage. You also see that he knew the effect he was having. It's perfectly reasonable, then, that a new book by Catherine Camus, his surviving daughter, Albert Camus, Solitude and Solidarity, published by Edition Olmes, is essentially a photograph album rather than any sort of philosophical gloss. Looks matter to the mind. Clever people are usually compensating for something, even if the wound that makes them draw the bow of art is no worse than an overlarge schnoz and sticking out ears. The ugly man who thinks hard, Socrates or Sartre, is using his mind to make up for his face. Camus once saw Sartre over-wooing a pretty girl and wonder why he didn't, as Camus would have done, play it cool. "You've seen my face?" Sartre answered honestly. When handsome men or beautiful women take up the work of the intellect, it impresses us because we know they could have chosen the other path to being impressive. That they chose the path of the mind suggests that there is on it something more worthwhile than a circuitous route to the good things that the good-looking get just by showing up. And then the image of Camus persists. We recall him not just as a fine writer, but as an exemplary man, a kind of secular saint, the spirit of his time, as well as the last French writer whom most Americans know something about. French literary critics sometimes treat him with the note of condescension that authors of high school classics get here too. A tone that the French writer Michel Onfray, in his newly published Life of Camus, tries to remedy, insisting that Camus was not only a better writer, but a more interesting, systematic thinker than Sartre. The skepticism of his native readers isn't just snobbish, though. Read today, Camus is perhaps more memorable as a great journalist, as a diarist and editorialist, than as a novelist and philosopher. He wrote beautifully, even when he thought conventionally, and the sober lucidity of his writing is, in a sense, the true timbre of the thought Olivier Todd, the author of the standard biography in French, suggests that Camus might have benefited by knowing more about his anti-totalitarian Anglo-American contemporaries, Popper and Orwell among them. Yet, in truth, the big question Camus asked was never the Anglo-American liberal one, how can we make the world a little bit better tomorrow? It was the grander French one, why not kill yourself tonight? That the answers came to much the same thing in the end, easy does it, tomorrow may be a bit better than today, and after all, you have to have a little faith in people, doesn't diminish the glamour that clings to the man who turned the question over and looked at it elegantly upside down. Camus was a first-rate philosophy student, and the French meritocratic system had purchased even in the distant province of Algiers. He quickly advanced at the local university, writing a thesis on Plotinus and St. Augustine when he was in his early 20s. After a flirtation with communism, he left for the mainland in 1940 with the manuscript of a novel in his suitcase and the ambition to be a journalist in his heart. He worked briefly for the newspaper Paris Soir and then returned to North Africa, where he finished two books. By 1943, he was back in France to join the staff of the clandestine resistance newspaper Combat and publish those books, first the novel, The Stranger, and then a book of philosophical essays, The Myth of Sisyphus. Part of the paralyzing narcotic of the occupation was that writing could still go on. It was the Germans' interest to allow, it was in the Germans' interest to allow the publication of books that seemed remote enough not to be subversive. The novel and the essays announced the same theme, though the novel did it on a downdraft and the essays on uplift. Meaning is where you make it, and life is absurd. In the novel, Camus meant absurd in the sense of pointless, in the essays in the sense of unjustified by certainty. Life is absurd because why bother? And life is also absurd because who knows? The Stranger tells the story of an alienated Franco-Algerian, Mersault, who kills an Arab on the beach one day for no good reason. The no good reason is key. If it's possible to act for no good reason, maybe there is never any reason to talk about good when you act. The world is absurd, Mersault thinks, and Camus seconds, because without divine order or even much pointed human purpose, it's just one damn thing after another, and you might as well be damned for one thing as the next. In a world bleached dry of significance, the most immoral act might seem as meaningful as the best one. The drained, eye-straining beach where Mersault murders his victim is a place not just without meaning, but without real feeling. It became the deadened landscape and the cityscape that was populated in the decade by everyone from Giacometti's emaciated walking figures to Bogart's private eyes. In Sisyphus, though, Camus offers a way to keep Mersault's absurdity from becoming merely murderous. We are all Sisyphus, he says, condemned to roll our boulder uphill and then watch it roll back down for eternity, or at least until we die. Learning to roll the boulder while keeping at least a half smile on your face, one must imagine Sisyphus happy is his most emphatic aphorism, is the only way to act decently while accepting that acts are always essentially absurd. It was the editorials that Camus wrote for Combat that sustained his reputation. Editorial writers can seem the most insipid and helpless of the scribbling class. They sum up anonymously the ideas of their time and truth and insipidity, do a great deal of close dancing. The right thing to do is often hard, but seldom surprising. Good editorial writing has less to do with winning an argument, since the other side is mostly not listening, than with telling the guys on your side how they ought to sound when they're arguing. It's a form of conducting, really, where the writer tries to strike a downbeat, a tonic note, for the whole of his section. Not say this, but sound this way is what the great editorialists teach. What Camus wanted wasn't new, just liberty, equality, and fraternity. But he found a new way to say it. Tone was what mattered. He discovered a way of speaking on the page that was unlike either the violent rhetorical cliches of communism or the ponderous abstractions of the Catholic Rite. He struck a tone not of Voltairean Parisian rancor, but of melancholic loft. Camus sounds serious, but he also sounds sad. He added the authority of sadness to the activity of political writing. He wrote with dignity, at a moment when restoring dignity to public language was necessary, and he slowed public language at a time when history was moving too fast. At the Liberation, he wrote, in Arthur Goldhammer's translation. Now that we have won the means to express ourselves, our responsibility to ourselves and to the country is paramount. The task for each of us is to think carefully about what he wants to say and gradually to shape the spirit of his paper. It is to write carefully without ever losing sight of the urgent need to restore to the country its authoritative voice. If we see to it that that voice remains one of vigor rather than hatred, of proud objectivity and not rhetoric, of humanity rather than mediocrity, then much will be saved from ruin. Responsibility, care, gradualness, humanity, even at a time of jubilation, these are the typical words of Camus, and they are not the usual words of French political rhetoric. The enemy was not this side or that one. It was the abstraction of rhetoric itself. Camus wrote, "We have witnessed lying, humiliation, killing, deportation, and torture, and in each instance it was impossible to persuade the people who were doing these things not to do them, because they were sure of themselves and because there is no way of persuading an abstraction." Sartre, in a signed Man on the Scene column for Combat, wrote that the liberation had been a, quote, time of intoxication and joy, end quote. Actually, Sartre kept off the streets and let Simone de Beauvoir do the writing while he took the byline. But intoxication and joy were the last things that Camus thought freedom should bring. His watchwords were anxiety and responsibility. The previous article was shortened for this broadcast. And now I will read excerpts from the editorials that Albert Camus wrote in 1946 for the newspaper Combat. Neither victims nor executioners, the century of fear. The 17th century was the century of mathematics. The 18th century was the century of physical science. And the 19th, the century of biology. Our 20th century is the century of fear. Fear isn't a science, you may be thinking. Well, to begin with, science is no stranger to fear, since the latest theoretical advances have led science to repudiate itself, and since its practical applications threaten the entire earth with destruction. Furthermore, even if fear can't be considered a science in itself, there is no question that it is a method. Indeed, what is most striking about the world we live in is, first of all, the fact that most people, broadly speaking, are deprived of any future, other than believers of one sort or another. No worthwhile life is possible without projection onto the future, without promise of development and progress. To live with one's back to a wall is a dog's life. But people of my generation and of the generation just now taking its place in factories and classrooms have lived and are living more and more like dogs. Of course, this is not the first time that people have faced a materially obstructed future. In the past, however, they used to overcome obstacles by speaking out or shouting out their discontent. They appealed to a different set of values on which they pinned their hopes. Today, no one is talking, apart from those who repeat themselves, because the world seems to us to be led by forces blind and deaf to warnings, advice, and supplications. Something in us succumbed to recent experience. That something is man's eternal confidence, which always fostered the belief that we could elicit human reactions from other human beings by speaking to them in the language of humanity. We have witnessed lying, humiliation, killing, deportation, and torture, and in each instance it was impossible to persuade the people who were doing these things not to do them, because they were very sure of themselves, and because there is no way of persuading an abstraction. Or to put it another way, the representative of an ideology. The long dialogue among human beings has now come to an end. And of course, a man who cannot be persuaded is a man who makes others afraid. So that alongside people who stopped speaking because they deemed it pointless to try, a vast conspiracy of silence has arisen and continues to spread. A conspiracy accepted by those who quake in fear and who find every reason in the world to hide their quaking from themselves, and encouraged by those who find it in their interest to do so. You must not talk about the purge of artists in Russia, because that would play into the hands of the reactionaries. You must keep silent about the British and American decision to keep Franco in power, because to talk about it would play into the hands of communism. As I said earlier, fear is a method. Between the very general fear of a war, for which everyone is preparing, and the very specific fear of lethal ideologies, it is therefore quite true that we live in terror. We live in terror because persuasion is no longer possible, because man has been delivered entirely into the hands of history and can no longer turn toward that part of himself which is as true as the historic part, and which he discovers when he confronts the beauty of the world and of people's faces. And because we live in a world of abstraction, a world of bureaucracy and machinery, of absolute ideas and of messianism without subtlety, we gasp for air among people who believe they are absolutely right, whether it be in their machines or their ideas. And for all who cannot live without dialogue and the friendship of other human beings, this silence is the end of the world. In order to escape from this terror, we need to be able to think and to act on the basis of our thoughts. But the problem is that terror does not create a climate conducive to thinking. My view, however, is that rather than blame our fear, we should regard it as a basic element of the situation and try to remedy it. And if fear is not the right climate for proper reflection, then they must first come to terms with fear. In order to come to terms with fear, we need to understand what it signifies and what it rejects. It signifies and rejects the same fact: a world in which murder is legitimate and human life is considered futile. Therein lies today's primary political problem. And now, Albert Camus' 1946 editorial on international democracy and dictatorship. Today, we know that there are no more islands and that borders are meaningless. We know that in an ever-accelerating world in which the Atlantic can be crossed in less than a day, and Moscow communicates with Washington in a few hours, we are forced to embrace solidarity or cooperation depending on the situation. What the 1940s taught us was that harm done to a student in Prague also injured the worker in Clichy, that bloodshed on a riverbank in Central Europe could bring a Texas farmer to spill his blood in the Ardennes, a place he had never seen. There is no longer any such thing as isolated suffering, and no instance of torture anywhere in the world is without effects on our daily lives. Many Americans would like to go on living within the confines of their society, which they judge to be good. Many Russians, perhaps, would like to carry on with their statist experiment, separate from the capitalist world. They cannot now and never will. By the same token, no economic problem, no matter how minor it seems, can be resolved today without international cooperation. Europe's bread is in Buenos Aires, and the Siberian machine tools are manufactured in Detroit. Today, tragedy is collective. It is obvious to everyone that political thought increasingly finds itself overtaken by events. France, for example, began the War of 1914 with the resources of 1870, and the War of 1939 with the resources of 1918. But anachronistic thinking is not peculiar to the French. For now, it will suffice to note that, to all intents and purposes, today's political systems seek to settle the world's future by employing principles shaped in the 18th century in the case of capitalist liberalism, and in the 19th century in the case of so-called scientific socialism. In the former case, a philosophy born in the early years of modern industrialism, and in the latter, a doctrine contemporaneous with Darwinian evolutionism and Renanian optimism, seek to reduce to equations the era of the atomic bomb, sudden upheaval, and widespread nihilism. There could be no better illustration of the increasingly disastrous gap that exists between political thought and historical reality. Of course, the mind is always a step behind reality. History races ahead while the mind meditates. But this unavoidable gap is widening today as the pace of history accelerates. The world has changed far more in the past 50 years than in the previous 200. And today, we see everyone focused on the issue of establishing borders, when people everywhere know that borders are now abstractions. By the same token, if we never lose sight of the acceleration of history, we stand a chance of finding the right way to approach the economic issues of the day. The question of socialism did not look the same in 1930 as it did in 1848. The abolition of private property gave way to techniques for collectivization of the means of production. Those techniques involved not only the fate of private property, but also the increased scale of economic issues. And just as there will be no political solution that is not international, so too will any economic solution have to deal with international means of production, such as oil, coal, and uranium, as a first priority. If there is to be collectivization, it must deal with the resources that are indispensable to everyone and should, in fact, belong exclusively to no one. Everything else is just political speechifying. And now, from the editorial of November 29, 1946, A New Social Contract by Albert Camus. Let me summarize what I have said so far. The fate of people of all nations will not be settled until the problems of peace and world organization have been settled. There can be no effective revolution anywhere in the world until this revolution has taken place. Anyone in France who says anything different today is either wasting his breath or has a personal stake in the outcome. I will go even farther. Not only will there be no lasting change in the mode of property ownership anywhere in the world, there will not even be any solution to the simplest problems, supplying people with their daily bread, ending the hunger that is racking bellies across Europe, ensuring an adequate supply of coal, until peace has been created. Any thinker who honestly acknowledges his inability to justify lies and murder will be led inescapably to this conclusion if he cares at all about truth. He will have no choice but to assent to the argument as set forth thus far. In so doing, he will acknowledge that, one, domestic politics taken in isolation is essentially of secondary importance and in any case intellectually incoherent. Two, the only real issue is the creation of an international order, which will finally bring about lasting structural reforms tantamount to a revolution. Three, the only strictly national issues that remain are administrative problems that must be dealt with for now as effectively as possible until a more general and therefore more effective solution can be achieved. Yes, domestic politics does not deserve to be accorded so much importance. You cannot cure the plague with remedies for a head cold. A crisis that is tearing apart the entire world cannot be resolved without a universal solution. There must be order for all so that the burden of misery and fear that each must bear can be reduced. That, for now, is our logical objective. This demands action and sacrifice, and that means people. And while there are many people nowadays who condemn violence and murder in their heart of hearts, there aren't many willing to recognize that this obliges them to reconsider the way they think and act. Yet those who are willing to make the effort can expect to find reasonable hope along with rules for action. Admittedly, not much can be expected from the governments now in power, since these live and act by lethal principles. Hope, therefore, requires us to take the more arduous path, to start over and build anew a living society within the doomed society we are living in now. Hence, individuals working both within their own countries and across borders must one by one enter into a new social contract that will unite them again in accordance with a more reasonable set of principles. More precisely, the task should be to meet the confusions of terror with clear language and at the same time to set forth the values that a world at peace will find indispensable. Their first objectives could be to formulate an international code of justice, whose first article would abolish the death penalty everywhere, and to give a clear statement of the principles necessary for any civilization based on dialogue. This work would meet the needs of an era that can find no philosophy which offers the grounding necessary to satisfy the craving for friendship that Western minds are experiencing today. Clearly, however, the point of this exercise should not be to elaborate a new ideology. It should be simply to search for a new way of life. Let us imagine a group of people determined in all circumstances to set example against power, preaching against domination, dialogue against insult, and plain honor against wily cunning. A group of people who would refuse all the advantages of society as they find it today and accept only the duties and responsibilities that tie them to others. And who would attempt to redirect teaching? Above all, and in addition, the press and public opinion in keeping with the principles of conduct I have just set forth. These people would be acting not in a utopian way, but rather in accordance with the most genuine realism. They would be laying the groundwork for the future, and in so doing, they would immediately begin to break down some of the walls that we find so oppressive today. If realism is the art of taking both the present and the future into account at the same time, of obtaining the most while sacrificing the least, then who can fail to see that the most unmistakable reality belongs to these men and women? Whether these people will come forward or not, I do not know. It is likely that most of them are pondering the situation right now, and that is good. Yet there can be no doubt that the effectiveness of their action depends on their finding the courage to give up some of their dreams for now in order to hold fast to what is essential, which is to save lives. And at this point, moreover, before it is all over, it will perhaps be necessary to raise our voices. And now, The Myth of Sisyphus, by Albert Camus, as translated from the French by Justin O'Brien. The gods had condemned Sisyphus to ceaselessly rolling a rock to the top of a mountain, whence the stone would fall back to its own weight. They had thought with some reason that there is no more dreadful punishment than futile and hopeless labor. If one believes Homer, Sisyphus was the wisest and most prudent of mortals. According to another tradition, however, he was disposed to practice the profession of highwayman. I see no contradictions in this. Opinions differ as to the reasons why he became the futile laborer of the underworld. To begin with, he is accused of a certain levity in regard to the gods. He stole their secrets. Aegina, the daughter of Aesopus, was carried off by Jupiter. The father was shocked by that disappearance and complained to Sisyphus. He, who knew of the abduction, offered to tell about it on condition that Aesopus would give water to the citadel of Corinth. To the celestial thunderbolts, he preferred the benediction of water. He was punished for this in the underworld. Homer tells us also that Sisyphus had put death in chains. Pluto could not endure the sight of his deserted, silent empire. He dispatched the god of war who liberated death from the hands of her conqueror. It is said also that Sisyphus, being near to death, rashly wanted to test his wife's love. He ordered her to cast his unburied body into the middle of the public square. Sisyphus woke up in the underworld, and there, annoyed by an obedience so contrary to human love, he obtained from Pluto permission to return to Earth in order to chastise his wife. But when he had seen again the face of this world, enjoyed water and sun, warm stones and the sea, he no longer wanted to go back to the infernal darkness. Recalls, signs of anger, warnings were of no avail. Many years more he lived facing the curve of the gulf, the sparkling sea, and the smiles of Earth. A decree of the gods was necessary. Mercury came and seized the impudent man by the collar, and snatching him from his joys, led him forcibly back to the underworld, where his rock was ready for him. You've already grasped that this Sisyphus is the absurd hero. He is, as much through his passions as through his torture. His scorn of the gods, his hatred of death, and his passion for life won him that unspeakable penalty in which the whole being is exerted toward accomplishing nothing. This is the price that must be paid for the passions of this earth. Nothing is told us about Sisyphus in the underworld. Myths are made for the imagination to breathe life into them. As for this myth, one sees merely the whole effort of a body straining to raise the huge stone, to roll it and push it up a slope 100 times over. One sees the face screwed up, the cheek tight against the stone, the shoulder bracing the clay-covered mass, the foot wedging it, the fresh start with arms outstretched, the holy human security of 2 earth-clotted hands. At the very end of his long effort, measured by skyless space and time without depth, the purpose is achieved. And then Sisyphus watches the stone rush down in a few moments toward that lower world whence he will have to push it up toward the summit. He goes back down to the plain. It is during that return, that pause, that Sisyphus interests me. A face that toils so close to stones is already stone itself. I see that man going back down with a heavy yet measured step toward the torment of which he will never know the end. That hour, like a breathing space, which returns as surely as his suffering, that is the hour of consciousness. At each of those moments when he leaves the heights and gradually sinks toward the lairs of the gods, he is superior to his fate. He is stronger than his rock. If this myth is tragic, that is because its hero is conscious. Where would his torture be, indeed, if at every step the hope of succeeding upheld him? The workman of today works every day in his life at the same tasks, and this fate is no less absurd. But it is tragic only at the rare moments when it becomes conscious. Sisyphus, proletarian of the gods, powerless and rebellious, knows the whole extent of his wretched condition. It is what he thinks of during his descent. The lucidity that was to constitute his torture at the same time crowns his victory. There is no fate that cannot be surmounted by scorn. If the descent is thus sometimes performed in sorrow, it can also take place in joy. This word is not too much. Again, I fancy Sisyphus returning toward his rock, and the sorrow was in the beginning. When the images of earth cling too tightly to memory, when the call of happiness becomes too insistent, it happens that melancholy rises in man's heart. This is the rock's victory. This is the rock itself. The boundless grief is too heavy to bear. These are our nights of Gethsemane. But crushing truths perish from being acknowledged. Thus, Oedipus at the outside obeys fate without knowing it. But from the moment he knows, his tragedy begins. Yet at the same moment, blind and desperate, he realizes that the only bond linking him to the world is the cool hand of a girl. Then a tremendous remark rings out. Despite so many ordeals, my advanced age and the nobility of my soul make me conclude that all is well. Sophocles, Oedipus, like Dostoevsky's Kirillov, thus gives the recipe for the absurd victory. Ancient wisdom confirms modern heroism. One does not discover the absurd without being tempted to write a manual of happiness. What? By such narrow ways? There is but one world, however. Happiness and the absurd are two sons of the same earth. They are inseparable. It would be a mistake to say that happiness necessarily springs from the absurd discovery. It happens as well that the feeling of the absurd springs from happiness. I conclude that all is well, says Oedipus, and that remark is sacred. It echoes in the wild and limited universe of man. It teaches that all is not, has not been exhausted. It drives out of this world a god who had come into it with dissatisfaction and a preference for futile sufferings. It makes of fate a human matter, which must be settled among men. All of Sisyphus's silent joy is contained therein. His fate belongs to him. His rock is his thing. Likewise, the absurd man, when he contemplates his torment, silences all the idols. In the universe suddenly restored to its silence, the myriad wondering little voices of the earth rise up. Unconscious, secret calls, invitations from all the faces, they are the necessary reverse and price of victory. There is no sun without shadow, and it is essential to know the night. The absurd man says yes, and his effort will henceforth be unceasing. I leave Sisyphus at the foot of the mountain. One always finds one's burden again. But Sisyphus teaches the higher fidelity that negates the gods and raises rocks. He, too, concludes that all is well. The struggle itself towards the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. We've run out of time for today's broadcast. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Today's broadcast is available on podcast.